With little business experience, Jackie read everything on the subject she could get her hands on. She obtained the proper licenses needed to open such a facility, raised the money to buy the land and build the dormitories, and hired the proper counselors, psychologists, nurses, guides, on and on. Jackie had her own idea of what she wanted the place to be. Small, all girls, not a program where you had to walk miles before you were given a glass of water, a place of warmth and affection, but with structure and strict rules. All the girls were given clothing to wear. No competition in that regard. No makeup, no iPods, no TV sets. Close supervision. Outdoor activities all year round, but also areas for artistic expression, hobbies, interests. It was, in many ways, unique. Jackie did the advertising and marketing necessary to let schools and counselors know the place existed. She went to the necessary conferences and did all that was required to make such a difficult project a reality. And it is. New Horizons offers a 6 to 9 week program, and when a child ends those weeks, the counselors advise the parent on the next steps to take. Along the way, besides creating and running the whole establishment, Jackie became an accomplished business executive. She is not a therapist and does not work directly with the children, although she has told me laughingly that when she is with the girls and one of them says, "What would you know anyway?" she replies, "Everything," and tells her why. Again, it seems that a fairly large number of the girls who come to Jackie's program are adopted. Jackie thinks this is no accident. Jackie now has a longtime boyfriend to whom she is very devoted. They share many interests and seem happy together. Jackie doesn't want children. She feels she already has so many in the program. Once, when I complained and said, "I want grandchildren," Jackie replied, "Get a dog." So I did. The world's most perfect dog, a Havanese named Cha-Cha. She isn't a grandbaby, that is true, but nobody has everything. I am more proud of my daughter than I can possibly express. She is a beautiful, delightful, funny woman. She marches to her own drummer. It may not be my music, but I guess, in a way, I march to my own drummer, and it wasn't necessarily Jackie's music. A few years ago, Jackie felt that it was important for troubled parents, especially mothers, to know what she and I had gone through. I couldn't tell the story myself on my own program. It would have looked too self-serving. So we asked NBC's magazine program, Dateline, if they were interested in the story. They sure were, and they assigned Jane Pauley. Jane visited New Horizons and spent several days with Jackie and some of her girls, who, with their parents' permission, agreed to tell their experiences. Jane was sensitive and compassionate. She interviewed Jackie alone and finally the two of us together. Jackie and I sat side by side and told our own parts of the story. People still talk to Jackie and me about our appearance. One more thing. I keep reading about children who, as adults, want to find their biological mothers. Jackie has never expressed a desire to learn who her birth mother is. I thought she might be afraid of hurting my feelings, so one day I asked her if she would like to find out. If so, I told her I would help her. "Why should I try to find my biological mother?" Jackie said with a grin. "Haven't I had enough trouble with you?" "Yes, darling. Likewise." 9/11. And nothing else matters. By the late 1980s, things had greatly calmed down with Jackie. She was by then living in Seattle and had begun to find her own way of life. We stayed in close contact, and I was so relieved and grateful to have my daughter back. I was doing just fine professionally as well. There were hardly any major politicians, world leaders, and others in the headlines whom I didn't interview for 2020. Meanwhile, the show business celebrity interviews, on the specials, continued to draw enormous audiences. From 1985 to 1989, the programs were viewed, on average, in more than 17 million households. And who knows how many people were watching in those households. If things were going swimmingly in my professional life, I was treading water in my marriage to Merv. Beginning to sound familiar? The bicoastal arrangements were getting more and more difficult, and to add to that, Merv's company, Lorimar, was in disarray. He and his partner, Lee Rich, had split. And Merv took on three new partners, one of whom was a very smart young man, Les Moonves, who is today the president and CEO of CBS. Nevertheless, the company floundered, and Merv decided to sell it to what is now Time Warner. Although this gave him a great deal of money, it also meant that he felt somewhat lost. All of a sudden, he had no real place to go. The beautiful buildings, the lavish offices, the huge staff of producers and writers were gone. So here it was again. My worst fears confirmed. Another show business marriage, another theatrical empire vanished. Merv then started a mergers and acquisitions business and opened an office in Los Angeles and another in New York, although he had little desire to go there. He still felt out of place and unhappy when he came east. The marriage sputtered along, but by summer of 1990, we decided it had simply run out of steam. We were profoundly sorry, but we had both known it was inevitable. Merv and I separated in September of that year. There were no arguments, no bad scenes. To draw from T.S. Eliot, our marriage ended not with a bang, but a whimper. On my birthday, I came to Los Angeles and had dinner with Merv and his three children and their spouses, and knowing we were separating, they gave me a beautiful gold charm bracelet with their names on it. It was very sweet and touching. I liked my stepchildren a great deal, and knew I was about to lose the day-to-day contact with them. The thought of that saddened me. I also knew that Jackie, who loved Merv, would take the divorce very hard. I didn't want the news of our separation to dribble out in the press and to read the gossip and speculation, so I wrote out an announcement and gave it to my friend Liz Smith for her nationally syndicated column. The day before she published it, I went to a spa with a friend, so I wouldn't have to deal with all the phone calls. This, in part, is what Liz printed. It is with great sadness that Barbara Walters and Merv Adelson are announcing that they will be having a trial separation. For the past 5 years, this glamorous and very nice couple has lived a high-intensity, bi-coastal wedlock, with each traveling from coast to coast at least once a month. But now, Merv's business interests require his spending most of his time in Los Angeles, and Barbara's television assignments, instead of lessening, seem to have multiplied, so that she is traveling all over the world or operating primarily from New York. The twain meets, but the effort is gigantic. Our friends were shocked. They thought we'd had the happiest marriage. It is a cliché, but true. One never knows what is going on in another's private life. Our divorce was amicable, but even so, a divorce has its confusion and its difficulties, especially if you have depended on your spouse to make the major financial decisions, as I had done. I had never paid much attention to my own affairs and had happily turned them over to Merv when we married. When we split up, I decided to take responsibility for my own financial well-being. I was fortunate to have a wise friend, Linda Wachner, who at that time was the president and CEO of a large public company called the Warnico Group. Linda took me by the hand and introduced me to an expert accountant and another expert in insurance. She also helped me make some basic investment decisions. I was fortunate, but I empathize with the new divorcee, who may have to make such decisions without someone savvy to help her. I will always be grateful to Merv for his love and support of Jackie throughout her years of difficulty. He later married a much younger woman, and they adopted two children. They are now divorced. Since Merv lives in California, and I in New York, our paths did not cross for many years. When they finally did, I found myself pleased to see him, and today we are friends. I think that is enough about my personal life. The most popular of my celebrity specials was and is the Oscar Night program, which we started in 1981. Since then, I've interviewed almost every big star who graced a movie screen, from Elizabeth Taylor, Robert Mitchum, and Audrey Hepburn, to Denzel Washington, Tom Cruise, and George Clooney, to Helen Mirren and Eddie Murphy. Most people think I'm actually at the Academy Awards when I'm interviewing the stars, but I'm not. My producer, Bill Getty, who has been producing the Barbara Walters specials since 1988, as well as being co-executive producer of The View, always finds some wonderful location for me in which to do the opening and closing. Often, for the sake of a grand look, this involves climbs up and down staircases. I'm terrified of heights. I remember once we used the set of the epic musical Sunset Boulevard, and I had to walk down this long staircase that was supposedly in the home of the Gloria Swanson character. I was wearing spike heels and some long, billowy gown. I couldn't cling to the banister, and I couldn't look down because I was talking to the camera. I thought I would never make it. Another time, in another billowy ball gown, I had to glide down a very long escalator in a movie theater while the cameras recorded my descent. The escalator was so high and steep that what you couldn't see on camera was a stagehand crouching in front of me so I would feel secure that someone was there to catch me if I fell. We did this descent 4 times. The stagehand, I think, deserved an Academy Award for valor. Interviewing celebrities is often harder and much more time-consuming than interviewing newsmakers or world leaders. People seem to think I just pick up the phone and get right through to Michael Douglas or Julia Roberts. Not so. Over the years, there have been endless back-and-forths with agents, public relations representatives, lawyers, and managers. Sometimes it has taken months to confirm an interview. One of the most elusive stars was, you won't be surprised, Katharine Hepburn. After pursuing her for months, we finally settled on a Tuesday in October for our conversation. And wouldn't you know it, the weekend before our interview, I got a call from the League of Women Voters asking me to be on the panel that same night for the presidential debate between Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter. I phoned Miss Hepburn in Connecticut. Would you mind changing our interview from Tuesday to Thursday? I asked her. She was so thrilled to get out of the interview that it took us 10 months to get her back. The preparation is also much harder for the celebrity interviews. If you read the newspapers every day, which I did and do, you're basically up to speed on what a politician or world leader is up to. But there's much more homework to do when you're talking with a celebrity. Interviews with politicians and world leaders are about issues, but interviews with celebrities concern their lifestyle and their emotions. I scour every clip written about them, plumb their childhoods, watch the movies they've been in, pick up bits and pieces about them wherever I can. If I've done my homework well, at some point during the interview the celebrity may be surprised by what I know. Julia Roberts was very startled when I said, "You write poetry." "How do you know that?" she asked. "By reading, 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 and then talking to anyone who might have some personal insight into the particular star I am talking to." The conversational format of the celebrity interviews almost demands that I know more about the subjects than they do. I've already told you about writing every question I and anyone around me can think of. Working this way means that by the time I am ready to do the interview, I know every question and really don't need the paper. It is actually just my security blanket. It also means that no matter what my subject says or in what direction the interview goes, I can be on top of it. For me, however, asking the right questions has always been less important than listening to the answers. What do you mean by that? How did you feel then? While I'm on the subject, the biggest mistake interviewers make is to be tied to their question, sometimes, unfortunately, questions they haven't written themselves. The next biggest mistake is not to listen. And try not to interrupt. Earlier in my career, interrupting was my biggest failure. Most often a big star wants to do an interview to plug his or her latest movie. Fine. But I try to get that out of the way as soon as possible, often in the introduction. Sometimes the person is trying to clear up a misconception. I make that easy by asking one of my favorite questions. What is the biggest misconception about you? These days, there's a whole new trend, the interview as a confessional. Drive under the influence, cheat on your wife, take too many pills, go into rehab, make an apology, do an interview. You can fill in the names. That seems to be the daily fodder of syndicated entertainment news shows. On the Academy Award programs, however, we make an effort to go for the stars whose careers and personal lives are so interesting that they bear the test of time. We try to have at least one Oscar nominee. Once we sit down for the actual interview, I try to get the subject to forget the lights and the cameras and just talk to me as if we were alone in the room. I ask everyone to leave the setting except for the camera crew, and if the celebrity is a comedian, I ask the crew to please not laugh. I don't want the sound of laughter to go out to the viewers. This worked fine until I was interviewing Jerry Seinfeld in 1992, and he got going on some riff about a laundry detergent that had ads boasting it could remove bloodstains. "If you've got bloodstains, you know, laundry should not be your biggest concern," he said. "There should be something else you're doing if you're bleeding besides the wash." The crew and I were almost bursting keeping it in, and I finally said, "Okay, you can laugh." We just about exploded, whereupon Seinfeld shouted, "You're all fired, all of you, clean out your desks." So there went that rule, and our jobs, until we all rehired ourselves. Over the years, I amassed so many interviews that we started putting together compilation specials that drew on segments from my earlier interviews. The first, the 50th Barbara Walters special, ran in 1988 and was a huge deal at the time. 2 hours of excerpts from 70 interviews. Bill Getty did a terrific job putting it all together, with me peering over his shoulder the whole time. Bill loves to tell the story of the rule I laid down when we first met. "If I feel strongly about something and you don't, I win. If you feel strongly and I don't, then you win. But if I feel strongly and you feel strongly, I win." We have been together for almost 20 years, and sometimes I really am right. The old interviews turned out to be gold mines. The original uncut interviews were at least an hour, if not two, but what we'd run on air was only 8 or 10 minutes long. So we had all sorts of unused material to merge into theme compilations, like love and humor and fame. The one I particularly liked was called The Price of Fame. Here we plucked whatever the star had said about being a celebrity, the up and the downsides. The line I remember best came from Paul Newman, who told me when he had stopped signing autographs. "I was standing at a urinal," he said. I did more serious theme programs for 2020. In 1985, for example, we devoted an hour to a program about the transmission of AIDS. There was a general feeling of panic at the time following the AIDS-related death of actor Rock Hudson. To give light rather than heat, we aired a special the night after Hudson died, titled AIDS: Facts Over Fear. To prove that AIDS could not be transmitted through perspiration or tears, which was a widely held myth at the time, I held and kissed a 2-year-old child with AIDS who was clearly perspiring. Many viewers were horrified. But that was just the point. The doctor we had on the show assured us that he had been in close physical contact with more than 600 AIDS patients over the years and never contracted the disease. I was very proud of that special because I think it had an impact and helped to dispel some of the myths. Perhaps my personal favorite was a 1-hour special on adoption in April 2001 called Born in My Heart. You may remember that's what I told my daughter Jackie when she was a little girl. The idea for the special came to me because there were so many of us at ABC, and especially on 2020, who had adopted children. Our hope was that sharing our stories might make a difference in someone else's life as it had in ours. The special touched many people's hearts. It was a lesson of love told by people who were expressing their most intimate thoughts, often with humor. Connie Chung, who is Chinese-American and was then a correspondent on 2020, and her Jewish husband, Maury Povich, told the story of their original request for a half-Chinese, half-Jewish baby and the adoption agency's response. "By the time we find such a child, you will both be dead." They ended up adopting a beautiful Caucasian boy named Matthew. Dr. Tim Johnson, our medical advisor, appeared with his grown son, Nolden, whom he and his wife, Nancy, had found abandoned years before in Indonesia. One of our producers, who had done heartbreaking stories on the thousands of neglected orphans in Romania, introduced us to the two Romanian little girls she had adopted. Sherry Rowlands-Weston, the wife of ABC News President David Weston, appeared with her then 6-year-old Chinese daughter, the enchanting Lily. To me, however, the highlight of the program was my own daughter, Jackie, then 33, who had agreed to be interviewed by ABC correspondent Cynthia McFadden, herself adopted. Jackie told Cynthia how much she'd always resented being referred to as my adopted daughter. "I mean, it's like here you have a parent who loves you to death and you feel so close to, yet everybody else is saying, 'Don't you want to find your real parents?' Or, 'What if your real parents find you?'" A real parent, she continued, had little to do with giving birth. "It's the one who wipes your butt. It's the one who takes a tissue and cleans up your tears. The one who is there for the good times and the bad." "Who is your real mother?" Cynthia asked. "Barbara," Jackie replied. Interestingly, Jackie insisted that it was much harder being the child of a famous woman, hands down, she put it, than being adopted. As a child, she said, she had skirted the issue of my celebrity by first telling her friend that I was a teacher, and then eased closer to the truth by telling them that I was on TV and kind of famous, when one friend responded, "Wow, your mom is Oprah Winfrey?" Jackie said, "I about lost it, and I thought, well, she could be." I'd always felt that Jackie was born to be mine, and at the end of the interview, it was lovely to hear that Jackie felt the same way. "I was supposed to be in her life," Jackie said. "I can't imagine myself with anybody else." 5 months after the adoption special aired, the World Trade Center was attacked. I was at home on the morning of September 11, 2001, and saw the planes crashing into the towers on television. I raced to the office where Peter Jennings was already on the air. I was a huge fan of Peter's on the air, but not always a fan out of the studio. I thought he was one of the best journalists in all of television, but inside the company he had the reputation of being short-tempered and rude to correspondents, including me. He could also be dismissive and abrupt while broadcasting and pretty much hog the airtime. When this was brought to his attention, especially in my case, because we often worked together on special events, he would write notes to me apologizing. Then it would happen again. He almost couldn't help himself, but he will always have my deepest respect for the magnificent job he did on 9/11 and the days after. They would be his finest hours, his finest days. He never left the studio, bringing in interviews and reports from all over the country and indeed from all over the world. To this day, I remember the acrid smell of smoke that drifted the 5 miles north from the destroyed World Trade Center to ABC on 66th Street. I was too busy to be frightened. Jackie kept trying to call from Maine, but all the circuits were busy and she couldn't get through. When she finally reached me, I told her I was fine. And that was the last personal call I could have for 2 weeks. The news department gave out assignments. Mine was to try to interview any survivors. A very difficult task, because they were in such a terrible state of shock. I did manage to interview the owners and the chef of Windows on the World, the restaurant on the 106th and 107th floors of the North Tower. More than 70 staff members and close to 90 guests were missing. The owners were crying. So was the chef. Nobody knew at that point who had died or who might have lived. Over the next days, I was deluged with phone calls and pictures from the relatives and friends of the people who had been in the restaurant, hoping against hope that someone might have seen them alive. I, along with a great many other correspondents, went into the studio with Peter and presented our reports. But tragically, in my case, it soon became apparent that everyone at the restaurant that morning had been killed. 6 days after the attack, I sat down with one of the heroes of 9/11, the mayor of New York, Rudolph Giuliani. It was late at night, and he was exhausted, having spent his days and nights post-9/11 visiting firehouses, police stations, the morgue, the first responders at the hellish site, comforting the families of the fallen, updating the death toll at a daily press conference. The mayor was determined to return the city to normalcy, to rally New Yorkers to go about their everyday lives while trying to cope with his own anguish. You feel terrible, and you cry, or you want to cry, and then you say to yourself, I can't. I've got to figure out how we encourage people to figure out some way to get beyond this, he said. If he was comforting millions of New Yorkers, and indeed people all over the country, who, I asked, was comforting him? This was not an idle question. I had noticed Judith Nathan, his then so-called companion, and now his wife, standing in the shadows. Giuliani was in the midst of a bitter divorce. Judith Nathan, who I care for very much and who cares for me and understands me, is an enormous source of strength, he said. It was the first time he had identified her in such terms. Giuliani went on to draw lessons from the Battle of Britain and how the people of London had taken terrible casualties, terrible losses, but never given up. He quoted Winston Churchill. Courage is rightly esteemed the first of human qualities because it is the quality which guarantees all others. A year after 9/11, we aired a special memorial program, Grief Hour, with a group of widows and children of men who had died in the attack. We taped it over the year at a counseling center on Long Island, where therapists were helping family members, some of whom were very young, to rebuild their lives. One could not help but feel great pain listening to them. Some of the youngest children still refused to believe that their fathers were gone. After a year of denial, several of the widows were just now experiencing the pain of reality. As one young widow put it, a friend of mine said, "Oh, we miss you." I said, "I miss me too. Don't be looking for me anytime soon." I stayed in touch with some of the widows, a few of whom remarried. The children, too, over time, recovered at least to some degree. Children are often more resilient than one feels possible. Gradually, I lost contact with them. But when you become involved in people's lives, even for a short time, you can't help but be affected. I feel this way whenever I do an interview with people who have suffered through a tragedy. It affects you. It stays with you. You don't remember it every day, but it is part of what makes you appreciative of your own life and sensitive to the enormous difficulties that others face. It was the celebrity specials, however, that continued to make the network happiest. People just couldn't get enough of the stars. They were also a huge financial engine for ABC. The New York Times suggested that between 2020 and the specials, I was bringing in more profits than any other broadcast journalist. Yet I can't forget that in 1991, 15 years after I had come to ABC, and long after I'd begun creating those profits, my contract came up for renewal. And when ABC failed to act within its exclusive renegotiation period, I seriously considered leaving the company. I know it sounds ridiculous, but I couldn't get Rune Arledge's attention. Rune had a reputation of never answering phone calls and letting matters just drift until the person either gave up or agreed to whatever negotiation Rune wanted. My concern wasn't money. It was personal. I felt that even though I was supposedly a huge success, Rune didn't care whether I stayed or not. At least, that is how it seemed to me. Rune loved the courtship of adding a new personality to the ABC roster. Though I knew that if you asked him, he would tell you that he and I were great friends, I simply wasn't on his radar. He was busy catching other fish. In the meantime, I was on another network's hook. I had an astounding offer from CBS. I had been approached by Howard Stringer, then president of the CBS Broadcast Group, now Sir Howard Stringer, chairman and CEO of Sony Corporation, and Lawrence Tisch, the CEO and president of CBS. We had a secret meeting, which I realize now I should not have kept secret. I should have met with them in the most popular restaurant in town so that it would come to Roon's attention, but I didn't. So only I knew the tempting offer they made to me. My own news magazine program in a great prime time period, 10 p.m. on Mondays, with the best possible producers, one of whom, Andrew Hayward, would later become the president of CBS News. And the salary? A staggering $10 million a year. I discussed all this in confidence with my very close friend Suzanne Goodson during our regular weekend walks around the reservoir in Central Park. Suzanne is one of the least judgmental people I know, and the only criterion in her advice was whether or not I would be happy. My wise and most trusted advisor, Lee Stevens, had died, and my new agent, Marvin Josephson, had been in Israel for weeks because his daughters were there learning Hebrew. I called him about the CBS offer, but he was reluctant to return. I should have insisted that he come back. I didn't. I have never been as aggressive in real life as I can be in trying to get interviews. So Suzanne was my sounding board and let me talk things out. "Do I want to climb another mountain?" I mused to her aloud. "Just think of the furor over the $10 million salary. Do I want to go through the same scrutiny by the press and have my ratings put under a microscope every week?" I'd been anxious about anchoring 2020 by myself and turned down that offer. So did I really want to take a chance on anchoring a brand new news magazine at a new network with new producers, no matter how good they were? I joked, "I don't even know where the ladies' room is." And I said to Suzanne and myself, "The devil you know is better than the devil you don't." I cannot figure out to this day why I didn't tell Roon about the CBS discussion. I didn't even ask my faraway agent to see if Roon would match the offer. Roon continued to be very remote, but he must have known something was up, because he asked his closest aide, Joanna Bistney, to take me to dinner and discuss the matter. By that time, I had all but made my decision. I would stay in the place with the ladies' room I knew. Then and there, I told Joanne I was staying. She spilled her wine. Just like that, with no further negotiation, I turned down CBS. The very next morning, practically at dawn, a new letter of intent arrived at my home from ABC, and I signed it, agreeing to stay for another 5 years. Actually, I know why I didn't tell Roon about the competitor's offer, and I know why I turned CBS down. The truth is that I couldn't audition one more time. It is as simple as that. And so the years at ABC rolled on. The network wanted more and more celebrity specials, be they Oscar night or compilations, with or without a theme, but there were only so many really big stars around for the shows we were already doing. So in 1993, Bill Getty and I came up with the idea for an annual special called 10 Most Fascinating People. The hope was that we could mix serious interviews with politicians, doctors, and business executives, along with movie stars, sports stars, and recording artists. The key was in the length of the interview. The days were long gone when people would watch half an hour in prime time with Congresswoman Barbara Jordan, for example, but we hoped that people would sit still for a serious 4 or 5 minute interview if they knew there would be a TV star or a recording artist in between. And they did. The first year we mixed Clint Eastwood, Katie Lang, and Shaquille O'Neal with, among others, business tycoon Barry Diller, Jack Dr. Death Kevorkian, the writer Maya Angelou, and the most fascinating person of all, which we try to keep secret each year, Hillary Clinton. The special did very well, so well that 10 Most Fascinating People is still going strong today. Last year we talked with, among others, Victoria and David Beckham, the founders of MySpace, Bill Clinton, and in his first interview since being fired from his radio show, Don Imus. After 14 years, the program was still a great success. I would love to tell you that we do an extensive poll to determine the 10 most fascinating people of any given year, but the reality is that the list is put together by the tiny staff at the Barbara Walters specials, primarily Bill Getty, the executive producer, Brad LaRosa, the coordinating producer, two young associate producers, Betsy Schuller and Jennifer Joseph, and of course, me. This gang of five does all my specials, unlike a news magazine like 2020, which has close to 100 people on its staff. Although I'm pleased with all the retrospectives, there are times when I look at them and shudder. I have sometimes said that the specials are primarily a retrospective of my hairstyles. How many hairdos can a girl have? And what a serious, sober-sided interview I was in the early days. I've certainly learned to lighten up and put my best face forward. By the way, I learned which was the best side of my face to put forward from the late great British actor Sir Laurence Olivier. After I interviewed him in 1980, he held my face in his hands and told me that the left side of my face looked better than the right. From then on, I have tried, whenever possible, to be shot from the left. I had never thought about lighting, either, until Merv told me mine was awful. "Every Hollywood star always worries about their lighting," he said. So we went out and hired a superb lighting director named Chuck Lofthouse, and from then on, I have had lighting from the floor shining up at me or directly at me rather than shining down. Good for all of us, even in our living rooms, to remember. Though I may have come late to what many in television enjoy today, like having their own lighting directors, I've had a fantastic run, and to think I get paid for having fun. Well, the specials do take work, but I've laughed a lot with every comedian from Bob Hope and George Burns to David Letterman and Robin Williams. I've danced a lot with such varied partners as Bing Crosby, Patrick Swayze, and Al Pacino. I've baked cookies with Martha Stewart, ridden on an elephant with Jimmy Stewart, flown on a helicopter piloted by King Hussein, and sped through streets on a motorcycle driven by Sylvester Stallone, while wearing his leather jacket. The cookies crumbled. I don't get to ride too many elephants, and I'm not crazy about motorcycles. But I still have the leather jacket. Presidents and First Ladies, 40 years inside the White House. Now I will brag a little. I have interviewed at least once every U.S. president and first lady since Richard Nixon, up to and including the current president, George W. Bush. So here now, various impressions blended by time and modified by the events of history, with some special moments that have remained in my head all these years. And by the way, in some cases, I found the first ladies more interesting than their husbands. As I said, I never did a formal interview with Lyndon Johnson, although we had occasion to meet several times. What particularly struck me when we did meet was that he, who was outgoing and gregarious in private, had so much trouble communicating with the American people. In part, this was because he never became comfortable with the teleprompter attached to the cameras. He seemed stilted and cautiously afraid of losing his place. We talked about this one time, and President Johnson asked if I had any advice to give him. I said that it was important to be very familiar with what you were going to say, so that if you lost your place, you could ad-lib until the prompter caught up with you. Also, I told him that unless you were really comfortable with the prompter, you should not stray from your script, as you would most likely lose your next lines. This is good advice, by the way, for anyone using a teleprompter. My suggestions were probably the same as he got from others, but it didn't seem to make a difference. With his glasses perched on his nose, staring stony-faced into the camera, he came across as awkward and ill at ease, not at all the way he was in person. I knew Mrs. Johnson better. Like her husband, she was warm and easy to talk with one-on-one, but these qualities also seemed to disappear when she had to give speeches or make public appearances. I did several interviews with Mrs. Johnson. The first time, I angered some of her friends when I raised the question of her husband's predilection for attractive women. I felt I had to ask because the rumors persistently swirled around him. I tried to couch the question by putting the blame on others, as in, "Mrs. Johnson, many people wonder," etc., etc. If Mrs. Johnson was upset by the question, she certainly didn't show it. Answering serenely, she said, Lyndon loves people, and 50% of those people are women. Great answer. But my question was considered so impertinent that some years later, when I was at a dinner in New York, a great friend of Mrs. Johnson's, when we were introduced, refused to shake my hand. I remember feeling as if I had been slapped in the face, but I understood her reaction. To her, I was one more of those pushy, rude journalists. Maybe I was. In another interview, this one in Austin, Texas, many years after her husband's death, Mrs. Johnson talked about the fact that during their marriage, she practically waited on her husband hand and foot and never minded when he bellowed, Bird, get in here! She told me, It was a different world then. That was your husband. You lived his life pretty much. You had your own life, yes, but many things you put on the shelf, and many things I have done since his departure were on that shelf. Mrs. Johnson was so wise that I have often thought that if this were now rather than then, she might have run successfully for political office after her husband's death. At the end of our last interview, I asked Mrs. Johnson if she ever felt anger or bitterness toward her husband's detractors. Her reply has stayed with me ever since, and I try myself to live by what she told me. I am too close to the great departure from life to harbor anger. Mrs. Johnson died at the age of 94 in July 2007, a much-loved First Lady. I have written a good deal about Richard Nixon, but Nixon's two daughters' paths also crossed mine. There was the elder, blonde, reticent, Tricia, and the younger, more outgoing brunette, Julie. In 1971, I reported, along with NBC newsman Edwin Newman, on Tricia's wedding to lawyer Ed Cox. Tricia, with her demure white wedding gown and long blonde hair, looked like Alice in Wonderland, young and innocent. But this is what I really remember about the wedding. The reception was in the White House, and at one point, while dancing with her husband, Pat Nixon tried to give him an affectionate hug. The president stiffened and almost seemed to recoil. The following night, we aired the wedding again in a special program, so I had a second chance to see this poignant and telling moment. I wondered what Mrs. Nixon thought when she viewed the wedding footage. I know what I thought. I felt sorry for her and angry at him. Where were his emotions? Was he incapable of publicly showing affection? Evidently, his aides also noticed Nixon's lack of attention, let alone affection, toward Mrs. Nixon, and found it a political liability. Years later, when Nixon's private archives were turned over to federal control, a telling memorandum surfaced from Roger Ailes, then Nixon's television advisor, voicing his concern. From time to time he should talk to her and smile at her, Ailes wrote. Women voters are particularly sensitive to how a man treats his wife in public. Julie was the Nixon daughter I knew best. We are still occasionally in touch. Julie and her husband, David Eisenhower, grandson of President Eisenhower, have a son, Alex, and two daughters, Jenny and Melanie. Jenny has visited me and is the image of her mother. Not too long after her father's resignation as president, I was at LaGuardia Airport waiting to board a shuttle for Washington. There I spotted Julie looking lost. She had never in her whole young life had to take a commercial flight by herself and had no idea how to get a ticket or where to board. I helped her, realizing once more how life changes when power and privilege disappear. After ending his post-presidential retreat in San Clemente, California, President Nixon moved to the East Coast. I saw him now and then at the home of a grand dame named Mildred Hilson. He played the piano at her birthday celebrations. Once he showed me how to make sure that I wasn't cut out of a photograph. Put your arm through the arm of the person you are next to, and then they can't cut you out because your arm will still be there. I have sometimes taken that advice. In 1976, the year I came to ABC, Gerald Ford, who had never been elected president or vice president for that matter, lost the election to Jimmy Carter. Shortly after the New Year, I sat down with President and Mrs. Ford for what was to be their farewell interview before leaving the White House. What I remember most about that interview was not the President, but First Lady Betty Ford. Before the interview began, Mrs. Ford took me on a tour of the living quarters of the White House. It was meant to be a charming personal portion of our visit, but it wasn't. Mrs. Ford, it turned out, could hardly put a sentence together. She was slurring her words and was obviously inebriated or on drugs or both. Later, when she sat down with her husband to do the actual interview, she had a glass of some pale amber liquid at her side. "Can't you put that away?" the president asked with both concern and annoyance. Mrs. Ford answered that she really needed a sip or two. We barely directed any questions her way. When the interview was about to air, I had a decision to make. Should I show the part of the interview in which Mrs. Ford was obviously inebriated, or should I be considerate and humane and delete that section? My executive producer said he would go with whatever decision I wanted to make. It was my interview, my decision. Well, I was probably a lousy reporter because I made the decision to omit Mrs. Ford's slurred voice. We showed the visuals of Mrs. Ford taking us around the rooms, but I did the voiceover description of what we were seeing. If she had a drinking problem, I wasn't going to be the one to expose her. In retrospect, exposing her problem might have helped her, but at the time, I didn't feel I could add to her obvious despair. Some years after leaving the White House, a sober and reflective Betty Ford sat down with me again, and for the first time publicly discussed her struggle with addiction. She had been on pills to ease back pain and drank to ease the stress of being First Lady. Her husband and four children finally confronted her with her condition and explained how devastating it had become for all of them. Grateful but frightened, Mrs. Ford agreed to go into a rehabilitation program at the Long Beach Naval Hospital. We took Mrs. Ford back to that hospital for our interview in 1987. She had not been there since her release. She walked the halls with us and, with tears in her eyes, described her condition before her rehabilitation. "I couldn't remember anything," she confessed. "Telephone calls from one day to the next, plans we had, I wouldn't remember having heard of them." "So if you have physical pain, you take a pill?" I asked. "If you have emotional pain, you take a drink?" "I used the pills and alcohol to help me cope," Mrs. Ford said. "It was like an anesthetic." Right after New Year's of 2007, I covered Gerald Ford's funeral. He had died at the age of 93. All eyes were on his grieving widow. They had been married for 58 years. I remarked then that I thought the lasting legacy of the Fords was Mrs. Ford's founding of the Betty Ford Center for Alcohol and Drug Abuse. Few people understood the problem of addiction better than she did, and she used that knowledge and influence to help thousands of others. Betty Ford made her own kind of history. But here is my postscript. If I were interviewing a First Lady today and she was obviously inebriated, I would certainly air it. Times have changed. My interview with the Fords was 30 years ago. Today we let it all hang out, no matter who it is, and that's how it should be. We do have the right to know. Too much is already covered up. Jimmy Carter was elected as this country's 39th president 1 month after I came to ABC. His was the election night I stumbled through with Harry Reasoner. In addition to talking to Carter for my first special, I had other opportunities to spend some time with him. Here are two memories. The first was during the Christmas holidays in 1978. The Carters invited my daughter to spend the day and evening with their daughter, Amy, at the White House. It was enormously thoughtful of them. At age 11, Amy was 1 year older than Jackie. I was not invited. This was to be Jackie's day, but I could bring her and pick her up after dinner. Jackie had a happy time. She told me she really liked Amy and found her friendly and unspoiled. There was a party that night for the children of White House employees, and Walter Cronkite had been asked to read A Visit from St. Nicholas. "'Twas the night before Christmas,' Walter intoned to the delighted children in that famous mellifluous voice. I was invited to that part of the festivities. When the performance was over, and Walter and I were preparing to leave, President Carter asked us to stay for coffee. Walter and I have often laughed at what happened then. Each of us had hoped the president would say something newsworthy that we might use on a broadcast, some pithy kind of a Christmas message. Instead, the president took the opportunity to tell us about his hemorrhoids. Very uncomfortable and painful, he said. He might have to have an operation. Merry Christmas, I have hemorrhoids. My last anecdote about Jimmy Carter took place in the Oval Office in January 1981, just weeks before he was to vacate it. Rune Arledge and I, perhaps because we had so many encounters with Carter, asked if he could pay him an informal, off-the-record visit. I can't imagine doing that with a sitting president today, but that's what we did, and Carter, dispirited and depressed, seemed happy to see us. All his negotiations for the release of the American hostages in Iran had proved fruitless, and a U.S. rescue mission 9 months before had failed miserably. The newspapers, in recapping his presidency, were not only dwelling on the hostages, but dredging up his encounter with an angry swamp rabbit some months before while fishing in a lake. The rabbit had attempted to board the president's small boat. I didn't know rabbits could swim, and Carter had had to shoo it away with his paddle. It was a silly incident, but the report of the killer rabbit had been carried on the evening news of all the major television networks, making Carter look very foolish. And here it was being rehashed again. Rune and I were more interested in the election than in rabbits. When we asked Carter if he blamed the Iranian hostage crisis for his defeat, he said yes, but then surprised us by saying, "That and the Cubans in Florida." Why the Cubans? Because in 1980, Castro had allowed and Carter had permitted the influx of more than 100,000 Cubans, among them convicted felons and psychiatric patients. The Cubans had flooded into South Florida, particularly Miami, overwhelming immigration services and infuriating the resident Anglos and African Americans. The economy was in a recession, and the non-Cuban population deeply resented the havoc caused by the influx of refugees and the millions of U.S. tax dollars being spent on them. It was costly in political popularity, Carter later admitted in his presidential memoir, Keeping Faith. As a result, Carter, who had won the state of Florida in 1976, lost it in 1980. But as history has recorded, Carter has become a more admired ex-president than president. As for Rosalind Carter, I found her distant and chilly, but I applaud her attention while First Lady to those suffering with the misery of mental illness. She brought about greater understanding and helped millions to seek assistance. It was an important contribution. Congress even passed legislation she had introduced, the Mental Health Systems Act of 1980, but it was never implemented by the incoming Reagan administration. In spite of his great success in negotiating a peace treaty between Israel and Egypt and returning the Panama Canal to its rightful owner, Jimmy Carter never really recovered from the series of crises that plagued his later years in office, not the least of which was the 1979 energy crisis that resulted in gas rationing and long lines at the pumps. In what became known as his malaise speech, Carter called on the country to carpool, drive slower, and turn down their thermostats to reduce our dependency on foreign oil. It was a message Americans did not want to hear or heed. But if Jimmy Carter's presidency ended on a note of despair, his successor, Ronald Reagan, began his presidency on a high note of hope. When Reagan came into office in 1981, the country entered into a state of near euphoria. No sacrifices were called for with the arrival of good-natured, optimistic Ronnie and his ever-so-stylish wife, Nancy. The American people much preferred this optimistic view of the world. I had interviewed Reagan as a candidate. He was certainly affable, but I couldn't help but be struck by his lack of knowledge in specific important areas. For example, there was a lot of talk in the press back then, as now, about Israel achieving peace with all its Arab neighbors by returning the land it had occupied since the 1967 war. Much of the arguing back and forth had to do with an important United Nations resolution number 242, which outlined the formula of land for peace. But when I questioned Reagan about it, he looked at me blankly. Not a clue. In the summer of 1980, I reported on the Republican convention in Detroit that nominated Reagan. It was an unusual convention. There was some concern that he might not be a strong enough president, and the convention was debating the possibility that Gerald Ford might be chosen as Reagan's vice president. As an ex-president, Ford would then have been a kind of co-president, an unprecedented position. Here is my own sideline experience at the time. I was in a room off the convention floor, doing special reports with Sam Donaldson and columnist George Will. The three of us weren't anchoring, Frank Reynolds was. Frank would call on us from time to time for special reports or when we had some news. My friend Alan Greenspan, a former advisor to Ford, was also attending the convention in an unofficial capacity. He wasn't giving me any secret information, but knowing him did give me good access. It looked as if the Ford nomination wasn't going to happen, and George H.W. Bush's name was beginning to surface. This was a surprise because Bush had run against Reagan in the primaries and had been quite critical of him. I knew George Bush fairly well, and I was on the phone with him in the midst of all the speculation about who would be the VP nominee. Suddenly, he told me to hold on, that Ronald Reagan was calling him. I shouted to my producer that I was about to get big news and to tell the director to put me on the air instead of just on the phone. But the attempt to do this disrupted the call, and I lost Bush. As I was trying desperately to get him back, NBC's Andrea Mitchell reported that she had just heard that George Bush was going to be Reagan's running mate. Good for Andrea, but I nearly went crazy. I had lost the scoop of the whole convention. At this point, George Will looked at me with disdain and said, "It's only television, Barbara." Well, although I enjoy listening to George and reading his insightful columns, he has also for many years earned a very good living from only television. The Reagan years, especially during the first term, were a great contrast to the Carter era. Hollywood stars attended the state dinners along with the other guests, all gussied up in diamond necklaces and fur coats. The wine flowed, the orchestras played. Except for Jacqueline Kennedy, Nancy Reagan was the most fashionable first lady we ever had. She was applauded by her friends but criticized by most of the press for her extensive and costly wardrobe. She loved the color red, and her favorite designers were Bill Blass and Adolfo, whose outfits cost thousands of dollars. Mrs. Reagan claimed she paid for them herself, but there were investigations and she didn't get off the hook until her performance at the Gridiron Dinner, an annual roast given by the Washington Press Corps. I was there when she came on stage looking like a bag lady, singing special lyrics to a Barbra Streisand song, "Secondhand Rose," Mrs. Reagan crooned, "I'm wearing secondhand clothes." She was a smash and had an easier time of things after that. Then, only 69 days after Reagan took office, he was shot by a mentally ill 25-year-old named John Hinckley, Jr. In a later interview, Reagan described to me what happened to him. "When we got to the hospital, I got out of the car first and walked into the emergency room, and a nurse was coming to meet me. And I said, 'I'm having trouble breathing,' and just then my knees began to get rubbery, and the next thing I knew, I was on a gurney. Incidentally, I was wearing a suit for the first time, a brand new tailored suit. I had to lie on the gurney while with the scissors they cut the suit off of me." Reagan also told me that the doctors went crazy trying to find a missing contact lens in his eye. It seemed he only wore one contact so he could see both close up and far away. I particularly remember this because I, too, usually wear just one lens, so I can both look at my questions close up with my nearsighted eye and with a contact lens in the other eye, read the teleprompter at a distance. The president seemed to put the assassination attempt behind him very quickly. In a remarkably short time, he returned to work. The first lady had a harder time adjusting. I interviewed her 2 months after the attempt on her husband's life, the first time she talked publicly about her fears and anxiety. She said the president slept soundly, but she often woke up in the middle of the night and then, wide awake, wanted to eat something, maybe an apple. But, she said, she was afraid the crunching sound would awaken the president, and instead she ate a banana. I thought that was very funny and very human. Perhaps this is the place to talk about the parents of the would-be assassin, John Hinckley Jr. After a 7-week trial, Hinckley was found not guilty for reasons of insanity. Doctors said he was schizophrenic. His motive, it turned out, was his infatuation with the actress Jodie Foster. He felt that by shooting the president he would impress her. After his trial, he was sent to St. Elizabeth's, a hospital for the mentally ill in Washington, D.C. There were many people, however, who felt that he should have been found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. After what I thought was a suitable time, 2 years, I wrote to Hinckley's parents and asked if they would consider sitting down and talking with me. I told them that it would be an opportunity to have people understand the disease of schizophrenia and might help other parents determine if their child had severe mental problems or was just going through a difficult adolescence. I promised them a dignified interview. The Hinckleys considered my request and agreed. This was the first and only time they did such an interview. It was aired in April 1983. John Hinckley Sr. had been a successful businessman in Denver, Colorado. He and his wife, Joanne, had 3 children, 2 boys and a girl. John Jr. was their youngest child. He was, they said, a beautiful and happy little boy. The family was very close, took trips, and spent all their weekends together. But things began to change when John dropped out of college and came home. He used to sit and stare out the window, his father said. He was very depressed and, in his father's words, could not seem to cope with the outside world. Eventually, after having John Jr. tested to make sure that there was nothing physically wrong with him, Joanne and John took him to a psychiatrist, who told them to stop pampering their son, make him leave the house, and force him to get a job. They were not to help him. He had to learn to be independent. It was a form of tough love, and the Hinckleys weren't sure it was the right treatment. When, at one point, their son wanted to come home, the psychiatrist told them, "Well, if he were my son, I would send him $100 and tell him goodbye." The Hinckleys were in anguish about what to do, but when their son did come home, unshaven and wanting to stay, his father said no. Joanne Hinckley protested, but her husband said they had to follow the psychiatrist's advice. There seemed no other choice. "I gave my son all the cash I had," John Hinckley told me, and said, "You are on your own." And that was the last I saw of him until the shooting. Then, with tears brimming in his eyes, Hinckley Sr. said, "It's my fault. I sent him out when he couldn't cope. It's my fault." The Hinckleys have since moved from Colorado to Washington, D.C. to be near their son, who is still incarcerated there. They devote their lives and funds to promoting research into the causes and treatment of schizophrenia and other mental diseases. To this day, I consider my interview with the Hinckleys to be one of the most important that I have ever done. I am indebted to those brave and honest people. As the mother of a child who had her own teenage troubles but thank goodness was not mentally ill, I sympathize with their confusion and grief. The main victim of their son's shooting spree was the president's tough, husky, funny press secretary, James Brady. His nickname was The Bear. One of the bullets meant for the president landed in Brady's head, and for a while he was at death's door. When he recovered, I also did the first interview with him and his courageous wife, Sarah. It was devastating to talk to this man. After the shooting, Jim could express himself somewhat, but his sentences usually ended, and he could not help this, with a wailing sound, like a loud, moaning cry of despair. He continued to make an amazing recovery, but there were ongoing effects of the brain damage. Sarah Brady, when she was not devoting her time to her husband and son, tirelessly lobbied Congress for a gun control bill. In 1993, the Brady Bill was passed. It requires licensed dealers to enforce a waiting period and do a background check of anyone purchasing a handgun. Just before Thanksgiving of 1981, 8 months after he'd been shot, Ronald Reagan agreed to let me interview him. Furthermore, he invited me to conduct the interview at his secluded ranch in the hills near Santa Barbara, California. No television cameras had ever been invited to the ranch where the president spent his happiest private times. Mrs. Reagan didn't love it there, and I could understand why. The main house didn't have proper heat, and she often complained of the cold. The bathroom was small, and it was more like a camp for a young couple than a vacation home for a president. As I recall, there were just a few books in the house, but this was just what the president liked. He wanted a comfortable, unpretentious home surrounded by hills and valleys where he and Mrs. Reagan could ride their horses and just relax, watch a little television, and go to bed early. There was a small lake on the property with a canoe called True Love, the name of the love song in the movie High Society. The film had starred Grace Kelly and Bing Crosby, both of whom Reagan knew well from his acting days. Most of all, the president wanted plenty of trees on the property that he could prune and chop into firewood. This was what he was doing when I arrived. I couldn't get over the fact that he was strong enough to saw logs when just the past spring he had been in the hospital struggling for his life. This was my favorite interview with the president. It was vintage Reagan, charming, amusing, and even poetic. As part of our report, the president drove me around the ranch in his Jeep. I sat next to him in the front seat. His dog sat behind us, thrilled to be with his master. The Jeep was all but falling apart. "Forgive me, Mr. President," I remarked. "I don't want to hurt your feelings, but this is the scroungiest Jeep. The upholstery is coming out." The president answered, straight-faced, "Yes, but remember, we have an austerity program going on." Later in the day, as the sun was setting, I stood with the president atop one of the hills on his property. He gazed at the valley before him for a while, and then he said quietly, "I've always believed that there was some plan that put this continent here, to be found by people from every corner of the world who had the courage and the love of freedom enough to uproot themselves, leave family and friends and homeland, to come here and develop a whole new breed of people called American. You look at the beauty of it, and God really did shed his grace on America, as the song says." He was not reading from a script. I went on to conduct 3 more interviews with Ronald Reagan while he was president, and shortly after he left office, and I probably conducted more interviews with Mrs. Reagan while she was First Lady than any other television reporter. She often said to me that her life began when she was introduced to Ronald Reagan. The president, too, once told the same thing to me. "I think my life began when I met Nancy." The Reagans' love for each other was never more apparent than when, during the president's second term in office, Mrs. Reagan discovered she had breast cancer and made the decision to have a mastectomy. 5 months later, she talked with me about that decision, the first time she had publicly commented on the operation. She had been criticized by some women for having a modified radical mastectomy instead of a lumpectomy, the far less invasive procedure that my own sister had. Mrs. Reagan defended her choice. She had told her doctors, "I want it over and done with." And then she added with a smile, "I told them it wouldn't take them long because I was never Dolly Parton." Her biggest concern, she said, was not the feelings of other women, but her husband's feelings. He assured her, she told me, that her decision would make absolutely no difference in their relationship and his love for her. She then went ahead with the operation. The Reagans moved to Bel Air, Los Angeles after they left office, and I continued to stay in touch with them. When Merv and I married, we also had a house in Bel Air. "What fun," Mrs. Reagan wrote me. "Who borrows the cup of sugar first?" We often had the Reagans over for lunch or dinner, and Mrs. Reagan and I became personal friends. After Merv and I divorced and I was spending all of my time in New York, Mrs. Reagan and I had long talks on the telephone. She had plenty of time then, as her husband had Alzheimer's disease and had entered what she described as the long goodbye. I was invited to Ronald Reagan's funeral in 2004. I attended it as a guest and also reported on it. It was symbolic of the many years during which Mrs. Reagan and I shared both a personal and professional bond. I have chosen to write more about Reagan's personal side rather than the historic events of his presidency because others can do and have done the latter far better than I. I wanted to give my own impression of President Reagan because, unlike several historians and indeed the common thinking, I never found him cold or hard to reach. True, he told too many jokes, several of which he had told me before, and though I may never have found him brilliant, I certainly didn't find him stupid or, after he became president, uninformed. I didn't agree privately with him on some issues, like his pro-life stand on abortion, but he was not a man who minded if you confronted him. He did indeed inspire pride and patriotism and confidence. At that time in our history, those were no small things. It may seem odd to some that though I say openly that I am pro-choice, I rarely, if ever, give my political opinions on camera. I have interviewed politicians on the left and on the right, but I doubt if anyone watching me knows my politics. Although this doesn't seem to be the style these days, I would like to keep it that way. Part of the reason is that ABC News expects its correspondents to behave with objectivity. Although I care very much about the issues facing this country, you would not know which candidates I favor in presidential elections or whether I am a Republican, a Democrat, or a free-thinking anarchist. Of all the presidents I've interviewed, George H.W. Bush was the one I knew best on a personal level. We met way back in the 60s through his younger brother Jonathan, a friend of my then-husband Lee. Jonathan had for a short time been in show business and their paths had crossed. I got to know Bush much better in 1971, when he came to New York to begin a 3-year appointment as the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. He had just lost his race for the U.S. Senate in Texas. He was beaten by Lloyd Bentsen, and at first was not overly enthusiastic about his new post. He was having withdrawal symptoms, he wrote me in a note. I believed in what we were doing. I thought it was fair and reasonable, but we didn't win. The UN will be an exciting place, and we must not look back. Barbara Bush was not always in the city during his years at the UN, and George Bush and I occasionally had dinner with mutual friends. I liked him a lot. He was smart, experienced, and had a sense of humor that followed him from the UN to China, where from 1974 to 1976, he served as chief of the United States Liaison Office. He did not hold the official title of ambassador, because the United States did not establish formal diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China until 1979. I must have written him there about the latest shockers in the Watergate scandal and the impeachment proceedings against Nixon, because his response took note of it. "Boy, are we isolated from the hot dope," he wrote. "We are loving Peking. There's a certain luxury in being out of the crossfire and turmoil at home." That luxury was short-lived. Bush came back from China to become director of the CIA, then to run for the Republican presidential nomination in the 1980 primaries. I never felt he had the fire in his belly that would propel him to run for the presidency. Obviously, I was wrong. One morning, after he had just done an early morning TV show, he called and woke me up, asking if he could come by my apartment for breakfast. He would be over in a few minutes, he said. I threw on a bathrobe, and over coffee, he told me that he had definitely decided to throw his hat in the ring. I was surprised and doubted that he had a chance. An inside note here. When I did the first draft of this section on presidents, I wrote that before Bush arrived, I threw on some clothes. I thought it sounded strange to say that I was in a bathrobe. But in the summer of 2006, I was at a party that he and Mrs. Bush attended, and I mentioned that I was writing a memoir. "Did you say that I came over to your house and you were in a bathrobe?" he asked. I told him I thought that might embarrass him. "Not at all," he said. "It's the truth. Write it." So I just did. Bush didn't win the presidency that time, but he did in 1988, after serving 8 years as vice president to Ronald Reagan. In the early days of his presidency, I went to a dinner at the White House and afterward sent a thank you letter. I received back a photograph of the two of us with the inscription, "Souvenir time. George Jr. told me he had a nice time sitting next to you at dinner." I barely remembered the conversation. Little did I think that my jovial dinner companion would one day become president himself. Thank heaven I didn't yawn over dessert. I also remember a very special dinner in the private family dining room at the White House. It was March 1991. President Bush had invited a small group of people in honor of Margaret Thatcher. I was delighted to be included. But the reason I particularly remember the dinner is that I was leaving the very next morning to fly to Saudi Arabia to conduct the first interview with our victorious general in the Gulf War, Norman Schwarzkopf. When the president learned of this, he took his place card, which read, "The President," and wrote on the back of it, "Norm, careful, careful, but she's okay. Congratulations again, George Bush." He then handed me the card to give to the general. Those were good days for George Bush. The bad days were to come, when in the last year of his presidency, in spite of winning the Gulf War, his popularity was falling. The race for the presidency was heating up. Ross Perot, the eccentric independent, was nipping at his heels, and the governor of Arkansas, named Bill Clinton, was throwing darts at Bush and becoming more and more popular. In addition, both President Bush and Mrs. Bush had been treated that summer for a condition known as Graves' disease, which is a dysfunction of the thyroid gland. They were both taking thyroid pills, but Bush claimed he was in very good health and no longer had any symptoms. Still, he had been turning down all requests for television interviews. I did my usual push, writing and repeatedly calling his aides, especially his media affairs assistant, Dorrance Smith. Dorrance had previously worked at ABC, and I knew him well. Finally, in June 1992, the president agreed to sit, and Mrs. Bush, to do what is called an in-depth interview.